It's a Politics Wednesday edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Today with us, Kedron Bardwell, professor and department chair of political science at Simpson College. Hello, Kedron.
Good to talk to you again, Ben.
Good to have you on the program. Tim Hagel with us in our Iowa City studio, associate professor of political science at the University of Iowa. Tim, thank you for coming in.
Hey there.
I want to invite our listeners this hour to join us with your questions, 1-866-780-9100, especially this hour where we want to reach out to undecided voters who may be listening. What do you think you'll do on November 8th, which is 40 days away? We have a new poll we'll talk about a little bit later that shows Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton tied at 38%. 13% of the respondents in this poll undecided. What are you going to do? Vote for a third-party candidate, Gary Johnson, Jill Stein, not vote at all, or choose Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump? Tell us what you need to know to make your decision about who you will support or the quandary, perhaps, that you're facing. 1-866-780-9100, river to river at iowapublicradio.org. You can tweet us at IPR Talk or answer that question on our Facebook page, Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page. But before we get to presidential electioneering, let's talk about some of the happenings in Congress, Kedron and Tim. We just heard in our news there, the Senate voted today to override one of President Obama's vetoes. This would be the first time in his presidency the Justice Against Sponsors of Terrorism Act would give families of September 11th victims the right to sue Saudi Arabia for aiding or financing terrorism attacks. Defense Secretary Ash Carter says the legislation could be devastating to the U.S. military. Here he is last week, Thursday, speaking to the Senate's Armed Services Committee.
Were another country to behave reciprocally towards the United States, that could be a problem for some of our service members. That is, I'm told, something that we in the Department of Defense should be concerned about.
Democratic House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi said late last week at a press conference that she will oppose President Obama if he vetoes the legislation, saying she thinks the families should have their day in court.
But I think that I think that members think that the families should have their day in court, and I think the concerns that the president has expressed are very legitimate. The families think that they've addressed many of those concerns in the legislation. This is difficult. You've described the difficulty. And many national security leaders have written about this, that, and the other thing as to reciprocity against us in other countries. But I think it's going to happen.
Nancy Pelosi of the House there. The House likely to take up that same vote by the end of this week. Again, the Senate vote just a few minutes ago, 97-1. To override the president's veto. First time in his presidency, Tim Hagel, give us a little some of your thoughts about what has led to this first possible override if it passes the other house.
Well, of course it has to do with the specifics of it, and it's difficult to say no to families who have been hurt by what happened at 9/11, family members lost and people injured and so forth, and want to blame someone, want to get them some compensation of some sort. So as a political issue, you basically side with the people, but of course the other side, the Obama administration, is very concerned about the bigger picture in this particular instance. But given that we're an election year, 40 days out from an election, it's a real tough thing for even the Democrats to stand with President Obama. And then you get into the idea that, well, he's also only going to be president for a few more months. If they have concerns about repercussions from a vote against him at this point, they're not entirely as concerned about that as they might have been earlier in his administration, even though certainly Obama would like to be able to say that he hadn't had any of his vetoes overridden. Still, one is not too bad, and you can sort of understand that the situation for a lot of members. I'm a little surprised that the vote was as lopsided as it was, but then again, that idea of giving that ability to for the families to sue mm-hmm. is something that's very popular among the people.
Versions of this bill have been floating around the Capitol as far back as 2009. So, and earlier, we've had voice votes on this. Kedron, what difference does it make now that each member of Congress will have a yay or nay attached to their name?
Well, I think I was surprised, as Tim was, just how lopsided the vote was. But I think sometimes what happens on these types of votes, where it's very politically difficult to vote no, you may have actually a number of more members who do have real concerns about it. But once they understood that the vote was going to pass, and particularly that it was going to get over the threshold needed for a veto, I think probably a lot of those people that had concerns went ahead and voiced their vote yes. So that's the politics of this thing. The legal complexity is something, you know, we could get into a little more, and Tim knows more about than I do. The fear is certainly that other countries and citizens in other countries would sue the United States military or sue the United States government on behalf or in response to our actions. And so the administration, I think, is legitimately worried about the breadth of this bill because it doesn't target, you know, a specific number of state sponsors of terror. It just says any lawsuit allowed against any country by a citizen who claims the country helped or supported a terrorist attack.
Right, and I believe at this moment there are only three countries on the U.S.'s terror list as far as state-sponsored terrorism, and Saudi Arabia is not one of them.
Correct.
Correct. Yeah, there are only three on the list, and Saudi Arabia is not one of them. And I think, and Kedron's right, and the administration has been arguing this, that it's going to open up the, as we heard Ash Carter indicate, to open up the U.S. and potentially the military. I don't know about the military specifically. Again, the idea is that the suit would be against the United States, and that's certainly going to have the potential to cost us some additional money. But on the other hand, a lot of these states that are doing this, they're doing things against the United States anyway. And so how much more this difference is going to make is hard to say. Certainly don't want to have to spend more money defending ourselves in courts and foreign countries. But that may be the price we have to pay in order to make sure that our own citizens are protected in a legal way from injuries due to, again, the state sponsors of terrorism.
Other action in Congress on funding. It was not supposed to be difficult. The House and Senate, as it was planned, I guess, they're going to pass some sort of straightforward stopgap bill to fund the government through early December and then head out of town. That did not happen. Speaker Ryan, Senate Majority Leader McConnell, House Minority Leader Pelosi, trying to hash out an agreement to break an impasse over the government funding as the September 30th budget deadline fast approaches. Kedron, tell us the basis of this impasse.
Well, it seems as if the impasse in this case, and we're sort of sitting here going, there they go again.
Yes.
Because we've been here before when, you know, some specific or narrow disputes or provisions, whether it's the debt ceiling or some other issue, essentially lead us to the brink in terms of whether the government's going to be fully funded. It seems in this case it is basically due to disputes over some add-ons to the bill that relate to funding for flood relief in Louisiana, and then Democrats' demands that, no, if it includes that type of funding, it should also include help to repair and improve the water systems and the lead contamination problems in Flint, Michigan. So, you know, it's one of those things where I think the American people kind of scratch their heads and say, you know, can't they all get along? And they see, you know, the entire government's budget being held up by things that seem relatively narrow issues but are very important to the people that are in those regions.
Mm-hmm. Does it play, Tim Hagel, does it figure into the fact that we are 40 days away from a general election? Would this be playing out differently were we not to have an election so soon?
Well, I think on the whole the answer to that is no, that we've seen this, here we go again. This has been the case for at least the last 10 years where it's been increasingly difficult for Congress to get anything passed whenever this deadline looms. And the fact that it is an election year, that does put additional pressure on one party or the other, particularly the Republicans, as the Democrats, whether they're the ones objecting to the rider or they're the ones that want some particular rider, extra spending, that they basically feel that if there's any kind of shutdown, that it will be blamed on the Republicans, as it pretty much usually is, that the Republicans haven't found a way to not take the blame for that kind of a shutdown. And, of course, if it happens just before an election, then there would be the potential for electoral fallout, especially if you've got races that are close, whether you're talking a presidential race or Senate and House races. And so as a result, the Republicans have often need to find some way out of it, and the Democrats certainly like to press their advantage.
Mm-hmm. A tweet from Chris referring to the previous item when the victims, 9/11 victims veto story there. Chris from his Twitter account says he's, if we would stop invading sovereign nations and committing war crimes, then our soldiers wouldn't be exposed to lawsuits. From Chris, join our conversation. We're also looking this hour for undecided voters. According to a Loras College poll, 13% of Iowans are undecided, 40 days away from Election Day. Kedren Bardwell of Simpson College with us this hour. Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa picking apart the politics of the last few days. Let's go and perhaps hear from some undecided voters, like Charlie in Des Moines. Charlie, are you there? Are you undecided?
Yes, I am. I am here.
Okay, so...
And I am... Yes, hello.
Yes, yes, Charlie, you're on the air. So what is your thinking about who you will support in November?
I think that the RNC and the DNC have both risen to too much corruption, and by both of them controlling the debate committee from, and it goes from there, but I am not an undecided voter. I have been a lifelong Democrat because I like helping people out. I like humanitarian. I like being doing things for humanity. And mm-hmm. I have now gone to the Green Party. And I was a Bernie delegate for the state, for Polk County District. And I've seen what the DNC did there and how they treated a lot of the Bernie supporters and skewed the results. And I am 100% for Jill Stein with the Green Party.
How do you view your vote, given that Jill Stein, according to this latest poll, polling 1% in Iowa?
I do not believe in polls. I think a lot of the polls leave Jill Stein and Gary Johnson out, and if they do bring them in, they're at the very bottom of the list. I think every time I listen to a news story, I hear about it down to the two candidates. Well, the biggest problem is the media these days. The media skews it to where you have two choices, and that is not true. And that is part of the problem. And so by voting for Hillary to change the party inside, within, is not going to help, because she is part of the problem, not the solution.
Okay.
We have to.
Charlie, we have other callers. Thank you.
We've got your
point loud and clear. Charlie in Des Moines, 1-866-780-9100, looking for undecided voters in Iowa in the presidential election. Greg in Waterloo, are you perhaps undecided?
A little. I commend you for having Josh Voorhees and Toobin on your show.
Jeffrey Toobin, yep.
Jeffrey Toobin had a recent article in the New Yorker. It's dated October 3rd, and it has to do with the Supreme Court. And so I encourage all undecided voters to read this article about the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has just not been discussed in any of this election. And the issues that are going to come up to the Supreme Court, justice, education, voting rights, civil rights, women's rights, all of these things which are so important are going to be dealt with in the next few years, and people need to look at these and decide how they would like the vote to be staffed, liberal or conservative.
Mm-hmm. Greg, let me ask you, are you undecided? That's what we're focusing on this hour. Are you undecided?
Somewhat undecided. I'm leaning towards Hillary. Mm-hmm. But when I look into stuff, I think that the Supreme Court issues are what people should look at to help them decide.
Okay.
And if they decide that they want a conservative court, then vote conservative.
Okay, Greg, I'd invite you and other River to River listeners to join us tomorrow. I'll have Senator Grassley on, of course, chair of the Senate Judiciary Committee, on the air. Greg, you and others should tune in for that and perhaps call with a question. Thank you very much, Greg.
Thank you.
1-866-780-9100. I wonder Kedren, what you can tell us about what we know about undecided voters and what they're weighing in their minds. Do we know anything?
Well, you can tell a little bit by breaking down the survey results a little bit more, and I'll just go ahead and plug our Simpson College Robba Research poll, which came out about 10 days ago and basically was online with some of Loris and some of the other polls. Essentially, what we were finding is that if you frame it as just a two-way race, there's about 15% undecided. But if you give people all of those four options, as the Green Party voter just mentioned, you get down to about 7 or 8% undecided. So that's maybe, if we think of it this way, about half of the undecided voters are kind of truly undecided, and some of them may not end up showing it up in the end. And it seems as if maybe about half of them are essentially third-party, you know, libertarian or green voters, that if you give them the option, they'll choose it. But the question is, will they last these last few weeks as they think about whether or not that vote may be wasted if someone's not going to win the election?
Mm-hmm. Tim Hagel, this new survey from Loras College is a bit of good news for Clinton. Two other recent polls in the state have shown Trump leading by several points, so much so that some media sources are putting Iowa in the lean Trump category. How do you evaluate this poll next to the other polls of recent days?
Well, I'm always not a big fan of polls in general. They've really got no way to compare them particularly to the truth. We don't know what it is, and we talk about a snapshot. But that said, there is some value to them. But at this point, the polls, as we're getting within 40 days of the election, they need to do a couple of things. They need to be looking at likely voters and have some sort of a screen to that effect to try to make sure whether apparently some polling outfits will actually look at voter history. So if a person has, in fact, voted several times or is a regular voter, there's a better chance the person will vote this time, and if not, then not. Or just ask the kinds of questions that you can get at. Are you, in fact, going to vote? How excited are you about it? But then you also have to look at what the voter distribution is in the poll compared to what perhaps it has been in the past. So, for example, with the Loras poll, I looked at it, and I don't recall the exact numbers right off the top of my head, but it looked to me like it had oversampled Democrats, undersampled Republicans, and no party voters in Iowa, at least compared to what we've seen in the last four presidential elections, where, roughly speaking, you have about Republicans about a point and a half, percentage and a half turnout more than Democrats in terms of that distribution, with about roughly 35% Republicans, 33% Democrats, and the rest no party voters. And so if a poll doesn't have something pretty close to that particular distribution, it seems like it could be oversampling or undersampling one party or the other.
Mm-hmm. Your view on that, Kedren?
Yeah, I think that Tim's right about all the kind of the complexity of putting together a poll to represent the population of a state or the nation, and that you want to look into at least a little bit into the subgroup numbers to see if they kind of feel right or seem right based on past experience. But I would really encourage just all of the listeners, as they say in the polling world, keep calm and follow the averages rather than getting excited about one or the other poll. And we had a caller a minute ago, you know, say, well, I don't trust polls. you know, most people don't trust polls when they're not in the favor of the candidate that they support. So it tends not to be a generalized distrust, but, you know, I like them when they help my side, and I don't like them when they when they hurt. So just keep calm, follow the averages, the national averages. You know, we're leaning a little more Trump, and we'll see if Hillary gets a small bump from the debate. But, you know, look at these over time rather than as a one-off.
You see, in the aggregate of polls, it seems that Trump is a little bit ahead in Iowa, but not too long ago it showed Hillary ahead. Kedren, do you have any idea what happened there to cause that shift in so many polls,
sure,
slightly in Trump's favor?
Yeah, now we broke it down a little bit in our Simpson Robba poll, basically looked at a couple of factors. The one thing that we found that was probably standing out the most was that Trump had improved the Republican share of the vote with voters without a college degree, either with some college or with a high school degree. And he'd basically flipped that from what was a Democratic advantage of about 5 points for Obama to about a 10-point advantage for Republicans. So that's a pretty dramatic shift just in about 4 years. We did find that Trump might even be doing a little better, but he hadn't quite consolidated all the evangelicals in Iowa that he needed to. And so if he can continue to do that, and if you look at the recent numbers, Republicans are doing very well compared to Clinton in consolidating their own party vote. I do think he could win Iowa by a few percentage points.
Let's, before the break, get to at least one more undecided voter on the line. Sonia, calling from Cedar Rapids. Hi, Sonia.
Hi.
Are you up? Yeah, thank you for joining us. You're up in the air. You don't know where to land yet, huh?
Yeah, because I generally have voted Republican. I'm pretty libertarian, and I would love to vote for Gary Johnson on principle, but I'm leaning towards voting for Hillary Clinton because I don't like Trump, but I also don't like Clinton because I haven't heard a lot from her about willingness to work with Congress and remaining within the realm of what is constitutional for a president to do. Mm-hmm. And that's concerning because civil liberties are very central to the way I think and to how I vote.
Mm-hmm. So that's your issue, is just the presidential overreach is what you see as overreach. Are there any other issues that concern you?
Exactly. Primarily that and economic policy. I don't think fiscal policy has ever really done much to solve anything other than create more regulation, which is something I would like to see a president reduce or roll back is economic regulation. I think the Federal Reserve and its monetary policy is a lot more effective.
Okay.
As far as economic issues go.
Sonia, thank you for your views from Cedar Rapids.
Yep.
Let's go quickly before the break to Michael in, is it Boxholm?
Yes, it is.
Very good. We've got just very few seconds. Sorry about that, but please make your point or your question.
Okay, so here's my quick point. I was a Bernie Sanders supporter. Now I'm up in the air. My thing is, I'm not voting for Hillary. I'm voting against Trump, and that upset me personally. And I have lost a lot of faith ever since the exposure of the DNC emails about basically taking advantage of Bernie Sanders. That upset me a lot, and now I'm almost to the point where I can't care enough about it, and it kind of upsets me, and I just want to know.
Well, does it matter very quickly before you have to go, Michael? Does it help you make your decision that Bernie Sanders is out there side by side with Hillary Clinton, saying this is very important?
It does. It's bittersweet, and I'm still going to vote against Trump, so I am going to put a vote for Hillary. But I know there are a lot of younger voters who are in the same boat as me, and we just need a little more clarification on a lot of her ideas going forward.
Okay, Michael in Boxholm, thank you very much for your call. 1-866-780-9100. Looking for undecided voters. What's behind your lack of a decision about the candidate you want come November 8th? 1-866-780-9100. Clinton and Trump coming to Iowa this week. We'll talk about that when we come back. Also, we'll ask our guests about that debate a couple days ago. And we're back midstream in this edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. When this Iowan was first elected to Congress in 1975, mood rings and bell bottoms were in fashion, and Gerald Ford was president. Who is it? It's Senator Charles Grassley. Senator Grassley now seeking his seventh term in the upper body of Congress. Tomorrow on this program, I'll speak with Senator Grassley live about several things. His support of Donald Trump, the Merrick Garland Supreme Court controversy. We'll also have him answer as many of your questions as we can get to tomorrow on River to River. Today, it's Politics Wednesday with Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, picking apart politics as of late, and of course, 40 days away from the general election that has a lot to do with presidential politics. Fresh from their first nationally televised debate, presidential candidates in the major parties, Donald Trump and Hillary Clinton, are making a return to Iowa this week. Trump holding a rally today at the Mid-American Center in Council Bluffs, where the campaign will launch Iowa Christian Conservatives for Trump. Tomorrow, Hillary Clinton holding a campaign event in downtown Des Moines to coincide with the first day of early voting. Talk about that, Kedron. Early voting begins here in Iowa tomorrow. I guess from state to state that's different. How does early voting shape the turnout and support for one candidate or another? The campaigns are certainly keyed in on this.
Oh, absolutely. And Iowa is one of those states that I think has tried to take the lead on this. We actually have students that have gotten involved in this issue, trying to promote both some of the early voting locations and expanding those in terms of geographic scope. But I know the parties as well are really tracking, how well are they doing in getting those early ballots in. Traditionally, the Democrats have had, in the last few elections, a pretty large advantage in early voting in Iowa. It's not that Republicans don't do it, but they're focusing on other strategies. And so one of the things people have watched just this last week is the number of those being requested and then coming in. And the word so far seems to be that Democrats are maintaining a lead, but that the lead is not as large as they've enjoyed in the past.
Tim Hagel, is that what you're seeing?
Yeah, pretty much. I notice a few people have suggested that the Republicans, at least compared to 2012, the last presidential year, Republicans are doing better than they did, but Democrats are doing a little bit worse. And Republicans have closed that gap, that they have worked on a variety of strategies. They saw how successful Democrats were at it. But Democrats do have a better machine for doing that kind of thing. The problem that they're facing to some extent this time is an enthusiasm gap. But that's also what was occurring in 2012. But the Obama administration, or campaign, I should say, understood that they were going to face that enthusiasm gap and worked very hard to overcome it with, in part, the early voting program, and were ultimately successful in terms of winning.
Reaching out to undecided voters listening today, what do you think you'll do come November 8th? Vote for Clinton, vote for Trump, vote for a third-party candidate. Not vote at all. Sit it out. 1-866-780-9100. Let's go back to our phone lines and talk with Bill in Des Moines. Are you undecided at this point, Bill?
I am actually not undecided now. I'm a reformed undecided voter.
Okay, what does that mean?
That means in the year 2000, I was in the undecided camp, and because I didn't think Al Gore was progressive enough, and I didn't like the way he distanced himself from the accomplishments of the Clinton administration, and I think Ralph Nader and the Green Party at that time was an attractive alternative. The thing is in Iowa that didn't matter much, but in Florida. In 2000, Nader got about 96,000 votes, but Al Gore lost that election to George W. Bush by 537, if I remember correctly. I think that was the figure. It's right around there. And I think, I understand completely the sentiment in undecided voters, and especially in this election. My preference would be that we had no political parties, that every candidate ran as an independent and ran on their policies and their individual record, but we don't have that right now. And I think if you polled some of those 96,000 voters in Florida who voted for Ralph Nader, take your vote back now or change it, would you not do that if you knew that that could prevent our war in Iraq and all of the bloodshed and the loss of treasury that went with that and all of the other policies that I'm sure they didn't agree with that were implemented during the Bush administration?
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's a short-sighted thing, and I think it's a protest vote. Bill Maher said recently about people looking at Hillary Clinton that they should recognize the difference between an imperfect friend and a deadly enemy. And I think that that's really sums up what we're looking at here. Hillary Clinton is a flawed candidate, but because she's flawed, to equate her potential presidency with Donald Trump to say, it's all the same, we should throw our hands up in the air and either make a protest vote or not vote, I just think that is idiocy.
Okay, Bill, thank you for your opinion, your view from Des Moines.
Thanks, you're welcome.
Andrew in Des Moines as well. Weigh in on this. Andrew, are you undecided?
I actually happen to agree pretty wholeheartedly with what Bill just said. I think I was pretty undecided when we were still in the primary season. But currently, I think I'm definitely leaning pretty hard towards Hillary for almost the exact same reasons that Bill was. I see these people talking about third-party candidates and voting for them because they feel like the two-party system is broken. And I totally understand that. I totally agree with that. In principle, but in reality, we have a choice between somebody who is inexplicably unlikable, you know, for reasons that people really struggle to describe, versus somebody like Donald Trump, who is objectively dangerous and seems to almost lack the respect in the American people that's necessary to sort of even pretend that he's going to do something else. He seems so overt and confident in his disrespect of us that it's almost intense.
Okay.
So this is kind of a situation where we need to be where while voting for a third party sounds just romantic and lovely, we need to really vote against Donald Trump. Unfortunately, I hate that argument, and I understand why people who vote for third parties hate that argument. But I don't think this is the election, guys. Sorry.
Okay. Andrew, thank you in Des Moines. Kedron, does this what you're hearing on the phones here from the last couple of callers match up with the theory? It seems to. As we get closer to election, the third-party candidates jump their third-party ship?
Yeah, that's what I was mentioning earlier, is that you never know how soft that third-party number actually is, and it can change even within the last few weeks as people take seriously the possibility that the candidate they like the least will be elected by their vote or non-vote. And that's the perversity of our two-party system. When you have those winner-take-all rules, if you vote for that third choice, you often actually advantage the person who is least like you on policy or least close to your position. There's fixes for that, but they're kind of in the la-la land, imaginary land of possible voting reforms, things like ranked choice voting or instant runoff, where you actually vote for, you know, you rank the candidates 1, 2, 3, 4, and then you transfer the votes, you know, from the lowest to the highest, and then you never end up essentially giving your vote to the person you like the least. But those are incredibly unlikely to ever pass.
I wanted to ask you about Iowa's congressional delegation, its role in the presidential election here. Of course, many of them up for re-election themselves, but all of Iowa's GOP congressional delegation supports Donald Trump. Senators Grassley, Ernst, also Congressman Bloom, Young, and King. Also, in addition to that, Governor Branstad. Tim Hagel, your thoughts on why in our state, when we see across the country many defectors against Donald Trump as the standard bearer for the GOP, for instance, former Virginia GOP Senator John Warner coming out today backing Clinton. Why don't we see that among any of the congressional delegation here in Iowa?
That's a question that's puzzled a number of reporters that have called me and say, you know, what's going on in Iowa? How come you see in the polls or you see the people supporting it? And one of the thoughts that I had about this is that when we had the caucuses, certainly the race was contentious. You know, we started out, of course, with 17 people on the Republican side. By the time we got to the caucuses, it was down to a dozen. But it still hadn't gotten that intense that we saw later in the campaign. And obviously Iowa, political folks or people that were tuned in were seeing what was happening beyond Iowa, but you didn't feel that immediacy here in Iowa that you saw in some of the other states. And I think that that helped to heal some of the hurt feelings and, you know, kind of build those bridges in ways that you didn't see in some other states and some other politicians. And so that allowed the Republican Party to come together a little bit more, a little bit faster in Iowa than it has in some other states. And sort of connecting that up to the previous two callers, you know, they were making the case for vote for Hillary Clinton because you really don't like Donald Trump. But for Republicans, especially some that maybe were in the never Trump camp, it's that same sort of argument for them, saying, well, look, okay, if you don't support Donald Trump, if you're a Republican, then you're basically helping Hillary Clinton. And if you think that she's terrible because she's corrupt or whatever, if that's your view, then despite the fact you may not like Trump, if you don't vote for him, you're helping Hillary Clinton. And so you're making that same argument. And like I said, as far as Iowa, in terms of the political establishment here, that they didn't get into that intense never Trump position. So for them, it was a little bit easier to come around and to actually support him.
Kedron Bardwell, your thoughts on Iowa's GOP congressional delegation in lockstep, no defectors there, all supporting Trump.
Yeah, and it's a little bit surprising for me, just kind of the amount of support they've given. I know there is always a question where you can watch, you know, how close they want to stand to Trump. Do they say that they're for Trump, or when they make their speech, are they just talking about how they don't like Hillary?
Supporting versus endorsing, whatever that difference should be.
That's been really interesting, and I've been trying to watch that as people like David Young or Kim Reynolds or others make their cases. There's definitely a variety of Trump support. in terms of how much you argue that he's the one for these various reasons versus, well, just the idea that Hillary we don't want. So I would add maybe one more thing to what Tim had said about what this tells us about the Republican Party or Republican ideology. I think we're learning a little bit with Trump that the belonging to the partisan team is a little more important to just rank and file Republicans than conservative policy or specific conservative policies. And it may be that the rank and file are driven more by concerns related to immigration, related to terrorism, related to racial issues, and not so much by, I think, the conservative intelligentsia or what they thought the Republican Party was driven by, and that was, you know, policies on lower taxes and less regulation and those types of issues. So I think this election has really revealed some of the divisions within the Republican Party about what that identity actually represents.
Kedrin Bardwell of Simpson College, Tim Hagel of the University of Iowa, about 10 minutes left, reaching out to undecided voters listening to the program this hour, 1-866-780-9100. Kim is in Des Moines. Says on my screen, you're undecided. Kim, is that the case?
Yeah, it really is. I went in kind of a Bernie fan, but afraid of how we were going to pay for things. But I've been drawn to that Trump side or Bernie side of kind of saying what needs to be said and not being, you know, a political puppet. However, Trump scares the bejesus out of me. And I think that Hillary, although I think she is very qualified to do this job, you know, I'm not sure that ethically she's who I want either. And then there's Gary Johnson, who I think I would vote for, except for what I've read about his stance on women is not necessarily supportive to women's rights. So I am completely lost.
Did you watch the debate on Monday night?
I can't watch debates. I get queasy, but I did follow it on Twitter.
Okay, you get queasy. So you didn't partake in watching it, consuming the media reports afterwards. I don't know if that influenced your undecided nature right now.
Well, I followed it on Twitter for the content, and then I checked the video highlights the next day. I don't appreciate the talking over each other, and when it gets out of control, I have trouble finding it a valuable way to choose a candidate. But based on what they said, I mean, Hillary's content was better.
Okay.
I think the fact checking even proved that, you know, she was truthful and Donald was still just kind of spewing whatever. But he also isn't afraid to kind of push the envelope. And I think government has been ineffective. Maybe he could do something.
Okay, Kim in Des Moines, thank you for your view. Let's spend the last few minutes, Kedrin and Tim, talking about your reactions to Monday night's debate. Kedrin, why don't you go first? What do you see as the takeaways from that debate now that we've had more than a day to chew it over in our minds?
Yeah, I've been talking to my students in media politics class about this, and there's this argument about how people kind of process information like this when a debate's held or when they get new information from political ads, that kind of thing. And what really strikes me about the way people see Trump and Hillary differently is there's kind of a gut versus head kind of reaction going on here, where a certain number of people just kind of like Trump's style. They like his aggressiveness. Even when a number of the students who are watching at the debate party here were seem to be siding with Clinton, I was walking around the audience and talking to people, and I talked to some guys, and they said, "Look, I still like him. I think he's aggressive, here's the things I like about him in terms of his personality." But if you went around the room and talked to others on the issues, and as they were looking at these specific statements Trump made and how they'd been almost instantly fact-checked, there were a number of other students who were really focusing on the head and, you know, analytically, can I figure out what the policy stance is that Clinton has? And it's a lot more easy to do with her than it is with him. So I think that kind of head voter versus gut voter thing is an interesting way to think about the Trump support versus the Hillary support.
Mm-hmm. In a nutshell, your reaction, what do you take away from the debate, Tim Hagel?
Preparation was key there. Hillary Clinton was clearly prepared. She knew that certain topics were going to come up, and she was prepared to address them in one way or another. And she also was very aggressive herself in terms of trying to get under Trump's skin. We heard that was going to be the plan, and it worked. And yeah. Trump tried to wing it, and he missed some golden opportunities to come back at Hillary Clinton in a more concise but systematic way.
Mm-hmm. This is interesting. Also looking forward to the next debate, I believe, in a couple of weeks. Donald Trump hinted during the debate that he held back on saying something, in his words, extremely rough to Hillary and her family. Then he insinuated that what would he have been saying when he talked with reporters afterwards, after the Monday night debate, and insinuated what exactly he was holding back and what he may launch in the next debate.
No, I'm very happy that I was able to hold back on the indiscretions with respect to Bill Clinton, because I have a lot of respect for Chelsea Clinton, and I just didn't want to say what I was going to say, and
which is,
I'll tell you maybe at the next debate. We'll see.
Okay, so what about this as a campaign tactic, as a debate tactic, to raise President Bill Clinton's infidelities at Kedron? Is this a good strategy if you were to advise Trump?
Well, you know, it's kind of in fitting with the character that he's had in terms of, you know, if he feels attacked, he'll immediately attack back, and it doesn't really matter what he talks about as long as it's something that will damage the other person. I think this particular attack would just completely backfire. The idea of, you know, parading Bill's former mistress or anybody else before the debate, as he threatened to do before this first debate, I think would just turn people off, and it would really cut where the negative narrative is for him, and that his temperament is poor, despite what he said in this last debate, and that he tends to go off, you know, in an instant when attacked. So I think this would be just a pretty awful political move for him. So I think his advisors are probably trying to rein him in as much as possible, despite the fact that some of his surrogates are still pushing this possible attack on Bill's infidelity.
Tim, do you agree with Kedron?
For the most part, I think I do. He would have to be careful. It's certainly a dangerous line of attack. But on the other hand, we recall when Hillary Clinton had said before that, you know, everyone that's a victim of sexual assault has a right to be believed. Well, you can push back and say, well, what happens when the people are accusing Bill? You didn't believe them, that kind of thing. So if he can do it in a way that shows that she's being inconsistent somehow, maybe. But still, there are better things that he can attack her on in terms of even the preparation line, or talking about the emails, or Benghazi. You know, there are many things that are weaknesses as far as Clinton is concerned that Trump could bring up without getting into territory that might be more difficult for him.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about the Electoral College map 40 days out before we part ways for this hour. Kedron Bardwell, when you look at the electoral map, Iowa, of course, has 6 electoral votes. Which are the key states, the handful of key states that our candidates are going to be visiting very often in the next few weeks?
Well, I think there's essentially, for Trump to win this thing, there's a two paths. And one path goes through Pennsylvania. If he can win Pennsylvania, there's very few scenarios in which Clinton can overcome that in other states that Democrats have traditionally won. The other path, if he loses Pennsylvania, he's essentially going to be counting on, for example, holding North Carolina, but also picking up Florida, Ohio, Iowa, Nevada, and he may actually, I think, in addition to that, need either New Hampshire or Maine. One interesting thing to watch has been that some of the polls in Maine have actually been quite close. It has a large kind of white working class community there. So that's, you know, if he can't win Pennsylvania, he really has to pull together, you know, a set of states that Republicans in recent elections have not won in terms of the swing states.
Tim Hagel, how do you view the electoral map 40 days out?
Well, it's got to be Iowa, 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 right? No. the problem, of course, we have is that with only 6 electoral votes, it's not as big a prize as others. And Kedron is exactly right in terms of that states. And that's what pretty much everybody is saying. And although I would say that most folks are suggesting that really realistically Trump doesn't have a chance in Pennsylvania, I guess we'll have to wait and see how things change. I've seen some reporters in Pennsylvania suggesting that maybe Trump does have a lot of support once you get out into the rural areas. So we're seeing that in some other states as well. But, yeah, that Ohio, Florida, Pennsylvania, that those are going to be key states, along with some of the smaller states that are swing states like Iowa.
Okay, thank you very much. Tim Hagel, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Iowa, thanks for coming into our studio. Kedron Bardwell, Professor and Department Chair of Political Science at Simpson College. Kedron, Tim, always great to have you on the program. Thank you both so much.
Welcome.
We're going to remind our listeners, tomorrow on this program, I'll be talking live with Senator Charles Grassley. He's seeking his seventh term. We have a conversation going on right now on our Facebook page. You can join in. A message to Senator Grassley, a question for Senator Grassley. Of course, we'll try to get to as many as we can. Go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page, and there you'll see a photo of Senator Grassley, and you can leave your question for him, and we hope you do. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Claire Roth, and Lindsay Moon, and Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. We always welcome your comments and questions to this program. You can email us rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. Once again, tomorrow on this program, Senator Charles Grassley. We hope you'll join us for that live conversation over the noon hour. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.